This is tomorrow's notice board.
Hello, my name is Tristan Nieslein, and you're listening to Tomorrow's Motorsport. Thank you for joining us. I'm joined by Nick Butcher, who between us both have businesses focused on transforming motorsport and the adjacent organisations, especially for me in ESG and sustainability, and for Nick, human performance. Tomorrow's Motorsport is a podcast that is focused on what's going to be happening over the next 5 to 10 years in the industry as we explore innovation, transformation, and the development of performance in this globally popular sport, but with the insiders and experts who know it the best. Nick, bringing you in here, thanks for being a part of this. What is it about motorsport that makes you want to do a podcast like this?
Thanks, Tris, and hello everyone listening to this podcast. With the caliber of guests and conversations we have lined up, I'm really excited to be a part of it. For me, with my background running in human performance, I'm really interested to hear how these professionals that we have on from a motorsport background are preparing for the future, whether that's on track or off it, looking at the bigger picture on subjects like sustainability and how they feel they can help innovate or support. All these lessons will hopefully be able to give our listeners some really key takeaways, ideas and inspirations to move their conversations and thinking forward, whether that be in their professional or personal life. So let's get started.
Perfect. So with our first episode this week, we're joined, I think it's fair to say, by a visionary. He's a world champion, a Le Mans 24-hour winner, and somebody who's looking to transform motorsport now with his new venture, Rebel Team. We're, of course, talking about Ferdinand Habsburg. With almost a decade of professional racing under his belt, Ferdinand is a young but incredibly mature racing driver, having competed in, amongst others, the Formula 3, DTM, and World Endurance Championship, where he won the 2021 World Championship, including that incredible win at the 24-hour Le Mans. There's not a lot that Ferdinand hasn't seen in motorsport, and we joined Ferdinand the week or so after his maiden win of the year at the 6 Hours of Monza. We discuss with Ferdinand his career, his approach to performance, and also what's coming next, which is really exciting with his work with Rebel Team by WRT. Ferdinand is spearheading this project, a really unique approach to going racing, and importantly, how you can be a part of it.
This is tomorrow's motorsport.
Ferdinand Habsburg, thank you so much for joining us on Tomorrow's Motorsport podcast. It's great to have you here. I think the best place to start is with a little bit of background. So can you give us a little bit of information about your career to date and what you're doing at the moment?
Hello, everybody. Excited to be on a podcast that seems to speak mainly about the topics that I seem to be interested about outside of the racetrack the most, that actually connect to the racetrack. I'm born and raised in Austria. I still live there now. I started in go-karting at the age of 11 and kind of climbed the ladder, went all the way to F3, then kind of hit a wall of like not quite having enough funding to go to F2. And the opportunity arose to go to DTM, and that just seemed like a dream come true in itself. So it made the choice quite easy and difficult, because on the one side, difficult because my dream going to F1 seemed to be going away, but at the same time, easy because it's just a really cool championship to be in. So this was in 2019. And then before then, the thing that kind of gave me most attention in motorsport was my Macau Grand Prix race, where I kind of came out of nowhere and overtook for the lead on the last lap in the last corner, but crashed with the leader. So crossed the finish line in fourth with only two wheels. So broke a couple of records there, but and raised a few eyebrows. And it was a special moment for me. Really, a lot of tears because I didn't end up winning it, but at least I'd kind of cemented my name in motorsport as somebody who's quite ballsy, somebody who's out there, somebody who's not scared to take a risk for a win. And it's what I think generally helped me a lot in the future when it came to just people. Whenever I speak to somebody who's offering me a job or offering me opportunity, they go like, you know, when I first heard about you in Macau, I couldn't believe it, you know. So it was just one of those special races. I felt kind of privileged to be one of the main characters in. Because it's weird, one of those things where you just you don't even believe it's you when you I don't know. Anyways, then went off the DTM for 2 years, and I really loved it. I got a really good relationship with Audi in the end, but unfortunately, they stopped with the Class 1 cars in that second year and went to GT3 cars, which meant that they had already all of their sort of GT3 drivers ready to jump in and take the job. So I had to go searching again. But luckily, my team that I was driving with in DTM, which I had, let's say, some success with, was WRT. So I started to have a good relationship with them. And they were entering this Le Mans program and asked me if I wanted to be a part of it. And I was like, absolutely, I'd love to. So I went off, and it turned out to be an incredibly good choice. We ended up winning the championship, the world championship. We ended up winning Le Mans. We ended up winning, you know, the last three races consecutively once we got going. And I ended up just getting a really good relationship with the team and everybody. And now I'm in my second year with the same program in LMP2 with WRT. And we've been having some, it's a different kind of feeling this year, but still decent success. We just won Monza, which was an amazing feeling. And I'm also racing in ELMS with Prema, where we're leading the championship. So good things happening this year. One more interesting fact, I feel like that's kind of important to note, is in that switch between DTM and prototypes, I was getting very frustrated. It was like lockdown and COVID happened, and it was making me think in different bandwidths in my brain. And there was a month where I actually hung up the helmet. I felt like it was a bit too much for me to like consciously say that this is okay. Like I started feeling guilty about the environment, just the impact that I was leaving. I started feeling guilty about the amount of money that we spend and not knowing that actually benefits humanity. And I don't know, just like a lot of thoughts came into my head. Then I got the call from WRT to race in prototypes. And initially I said no, but then it just seemed like something came to me where it was like, it seems that you stopping something isn't the way to go about changing a place or reaping the benefits as much as possible. So I agreed, but they had to conform to my sustainability project, which they ended up fully taking on board. And so I ended up racing that year completely carbon neutral. And I felt my conscience was at least a little bit clearer. And it was kind of an interesting point in my life where I started thinking a lot more about what's the impact of what I actually do in my life. So,
yeah. So, I mean, I think from my point of view, it's really understanding. You said you're in DTM there, and then you go from DTM into WEC and obviously Le Mans. Now, having been to Le Mans myself, and as a fan, you can very much go, you can enjoy the race. It's a fantastic atmosphere, but you can also go back to your hotel at night or your campsite or something like that. So I think from my side, it's really understanding what sort of preparation was that in terms of going from DTM, which is 45 minute races over 2 days, to going into stints that are 2, 3, 4 hours. What did you do to prepare from that and then ultimately win Le Mans, which is fantastic?
I've done like 3 or 4 24 hours races up until that point. So I did Daytona twice, once with Jota, once with High Class. I did the Spa 24 and GT3s when I was contracted to Aston Martin, and then with Audi as well. So I had, let's say, experienced the 24-hour race and understood already quite quickly what my strengths and weaknesses are. And interestingly, the only thing that you really need to focus on, I feel like, is your recovery and your making sure that you're as well rested and prepared as possible. And you're speaking to a racing driver who spent a lot of time already in my Formula 3 days reading books and being interested in sleep recovery, sleep optimization, nutrition, hydration, exercise, and that was mainly because I was researching a lot for Macau, because you do all of your racing in Europe in F3, and you're used to the same time zones essentially, and then suddenly, boom, the last race is in Macau, which is I think 7 hours difference, and you don't really have a lot of time to prepare. So I started doing wild things like experimentation with adapting my nutrition early on already, and I would already change my time zones an hour before every day. So the day that I flew to Macau, I was going to sleep at like 6 p.m. and then waking up at midnight, and then meeting my friends at the club, having already fully slept a full night because they were going out. That's a true story. And then going out with them, and then starting my day, and then going to the airport.
Sounds like a good way around, so actually.
it was really good, because also you have so much energy, you don't drink any alcohol, and you just have a good time. So I think my inherently, I was somebody that always was somebody that did a lot of warm up, that did a lot of nutritional focus, a lot of sleep. You know, in the week before a race, I sleep at least always 9 hours every night. Like all this kind of stuff adds up, because you want to be as well rested and as well hydrated through the week, and eat as healthy as possible, so that when you start the race, you feel as fresh as possible. And that includes like taking one or two naps a day, every day. Like when you find 20 minutes, mm-hmm. take a nap instead of going on your phone or any of that. So I think the main difference was just being even more strict with that when it came to going to Le Mans. And it ended up helping so much, because my fastest stints completely were at night. I was able to switch on at night so much better than everybody else. I was able to get up to speed quicker. I was able to maintain my focus for longer. And I was just able to switch off immediately as soon as I got out of the car. So I'm not sure if that fully answered your question, but I think there were some changes in there that made me, I maintained, because I was already such a nerd when it came to that stuff, but I just shifted up a gear, let's say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because we talk about motorsport, and you know, I would very much say motorsport on a track. You look at Le Mans from the outside point. You look at Le Mans, you look at DTM, you look at Formula 3, you look at Formula 1, etc. But actually, there's just so much difference that goes into that as what you have to achieve and where you have to peak ultimately. What's it like in terms of the compromise between sharing a car with someone than having a car set up completely to yourself? How do you adapt to that?
I'm struggling a lot with that this year, actually. Last year, my teammates and myself, we had very similar philosophies when it came to driving styles, which made it so much easier. Like you pick a setup on Friday and you just knew it would be good for everyone. And this year I have a teammate who has a completely different driving style from me. Like he needs a completely loose rear, for example, on the entry to the corners, because he doesn't like using the steering wheel. He likes using the pedals. And I hate using the pedals. I love using my steering wheel. So I need a stable rear so I can use the steering wheel for when I need it. To anybody who's in motorsport will know what I mean by that. But if you're not a motorsport and you don't know what it means, it just means that I'm better with my hands. He's better with his feet. It's difficult. I just wanted to hit on, but one thing before I go deep into that was that I like to compare different motorsports, kind of like endurance racing is kind of like a marathon runner, and Formula One or DTM is kind of like a sprint runner. Like if you took Usain Bolt into the marathon Olympics or some sort of long distance running, he just wouldn't do very well. He wouldn't be at the front. He'd be fine, but he wouldn't be winning. Likewise, if you took the marathon world record holder Mo Farah or something like that into a sprint race, he wouldn't be at the front either. So it just comes down to like your mindset, your training, and all of that stuff. Back to finding the balance between everybody. I struggled a lot at Le Mans with this, because my teammate was quite strong with what he needed, and I'm a bit more passive. I like to make my teammates feel as comfortable as possible, because it makes my job easier in the end. If my teammates are really fast, I know that as a car, I'll be further in front when I get in, so I'll have less of a problem. But it was getting to a point where I was starting to feel really uncomfortable with the car myself, and I had to like put my foot down in Monza and be like, guys, I really need something to help me to feel more comfortable so I can also perform better. We ended up finding some changes that helped me in Monza, which went against my teammate in in Monza, but in Le Mans it was the other way around. So we're kind of like handing off responsibilities depending on what the situation is. And in the end, in Monza, I did 4 of the 6 hours because just I felt really comfortable. So finding the right balance, we're able to find like different things in the setup, like making the tire pressure slightly different for each other that you can do, you know, from run to run. But it's difficult. It's not easy, especially because then you're in sports, your ego comes in, you get a bit angry, you get a bit frustrated that you didn't get your way. And you need to keep your mind cool because in the end, you just have to manage the situation, especially in endurance racing. And that ended up being one of the reasons I think I'm so well placed in endurance racing is because I'm quite good at generally being, you know, forgiving or easy to manage when it comes to finding a middle ground.
Mm. And I suppose it would be remiss of Tristan and I not to ask, as two people who haven't won at Le Mans, what does that feel like, those last few hours? It's moving down. Is there that wall like a marathon? People talk about hitting the wall, or is it just 1 foot at a time almost, and eventually you cross the line and you win it? What does that feel like?
No, we were leading for like ages. We were leading for like 17 hours. So we were just like in the front, you know, like we constantly had pressure from behind, but we never made a mistake. And we were just in a rhythm. Then 4 hours from the end, our air drag broke, which meant that we, you know, lost the lead to our sister car because we weren't able to change tires anymore. We were only able to change tires by pumping up air balloons under the car, where we'd lose like a minute every time we did it. So it was basically over for us to win the race. And I had it, one of my teammates, I won't name any names obviously, but one of my teammates was like throwing things around, like having an absolute like tantrum, being so frustrated and angry about this whole situation. For me, I was just like, and it's generally my personality, is very easy for me, but I was just so happy and pleased with my own performance. I was so impressed with myself in some weird way. I got out of the car every time thinking like, I don't think I could have done any better. Like, this is the best I've ever driven. And I was just so ecstatic about that feeling. Like, that was the thing that made me most happy. And on the last lap, unfortunately for my sister car, they broke down and we took the lead again and won the race in the end, which in some way or another, we felt like we deserved just because of how we drove. And in the end, we had a problem, then they had a problem. So it kind of evened itself out. It was for me when I saw them break down and we were back in the lead, I was like, oh, we're gonna win this. Like, this is like unbelievable. Your cheeks just flare up, you get goosebumps. Yeah, I'm getting it now. Like, I remember that, just that feeling of those last 2-3 minutes to finish the lap. It was just raw goosebumps and like a feeling of ecstasy. And then you just can't believe it. But at some point that kind of fades, and I remember feeling so content with how I did that whole week. And that was the thing that really got me driving better and better from there on. And, you know, I learned a lot. But yeah, that 3 or 4 minutes is like, it's literally like the best drug in the world. Like, you can't compare it to anything. Like, you're so calm and collected, but ecstatic and screaming, and everything's happening at different speeds. And it's a very insane experience.
No, absolutely. And I suppose, as you say there, your attitude is very much around you controlled what you could control. Your performance was good.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't control what's outside of that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what happened this year. I mean, I thought I did a really good job, but then I got wrapped up in an accident at the start and ruined the race from the first lap. So, you know, things change around. You learn your mistakes, and
I think the headline from this is that you prepared for your night stints at Le Mans in the nightclubs. We can make that connection now. So that's that's going to be depressing in the morning.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just do it the right way around, not the wrong way around. Otherwise, yeah, you're not prepared at all.
Exactly. prepared for the nightclub at Le Mans.
exactly. It wasn't the only prize you won, of course. You and WRT, your team, won the DHL ACO Sustainable Endurance Award. I think it was the first time this award was presented, and of course it references back to your care for the environment and your responsibility towards that, and clearly through racing yourself in a carbon neutral kind of way. What did that award mean to you, and what do you think were the things that kind of added up to that award being presented to both you and WRT?
I don't know. I'm not sure what I thought about the award. I didn't really care much for it, because I, like, once you've done your research and you've really dug deep into understanding where our carbon footprint is coming from, it's coming from transportation and shipping stuff around. And to have DHL sponsor that award seemed kind of funny to me. I don't want to like give some sort of odd feeling, but in the end, I did the campaign and I did put my effort into it because I just cared. Like I wanted this to happen, and I didn't do it to get an award or anything like that. So then we did get an award, and it was important to the team, I think, more than me. And the team was, you know, kind of doing it as a gesture to have me pick up the trophy. In the end, I think that the team deserved the award more than me, because not only did they fully accept all of my conditions to race with them, but on top of that, they don't just work with Drive Fast, Stack Fast, so they do a lot of other things, like they run all of their factories off of solar power and like really do their best in many ways outside of the circuit to be as sustainable as possible. So I think the award is good for WRT. I was just there to like receive it. I cared much more for my winning trophy on Sunday after the week later.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't think the two can sit in comparison. So can you tell us a bit more about Drive Fast and Act Faster and where you are at with it now and plans for the future with it?
It's a great question. Like I did it now a year and a half ago, together with a company called Green Future Project. They are this Italian-based company made by a bunch of young people, like people around the world, like people that work for Green Future Project sit like America and Italy and Spain and in Jordan, in loads of different places. And they work together to help companies adopt a more sustainable style whilst also providing them with like technological solutions to be able to show what they've achieved, to make it financially savvy for them. So like to financially benefit from making an effort, which is kind of just exactly the hitting it on the nail. Like you to be able to make changes in the world, you have to make it financially beneficial to whoever's adopting it, which is, you know, that's just the world, and that's fair enough. So they were creating loads of different templates and softwares to be able to provide information to their company and to their suppliers, to their sponsors, to whoever, to show what they've done and how they've done it and all that stuff. So they're really clever about the marketing aspect on it, helping companies do that. And I was like friends with a couple of the guys, and I asked them if they would, you know, help with a racing car, and they were like, we'll do anything. So they went in deep and did research on everything, you know, what's the carbon footprint, where's it coming from, just basically doing a full-on carbon audit of racing teams. Luckily, being a racing driver, I had all the connections, we could get all the information required, and we were able to put together a pretty simple but well-rounded portfolio, which you then basically give to teams and be like, listen, you can be part of Drive Fast, Act Faster, you have these, you make these kind of benefits, these kind of changes, and this is the impact that you'll have. And I've reached out to a bunch of teams where we are supporting a couple of teams. We're trying to go further than what we're doing now, to be honest. So far it's basically been doing a carbon audit, you know, giving some recommendations on where to make changes, if it has to do with transportation or changing maybe possibly sources of energy where you receive for your factory, and pretty simple stuff, you know, trying to reduce single-use plastics and all that stuff. And like one of the more fun things was, like, for example, getting people to use like team kit from ocean plastics, made of ocean plastics, which is done by this company called 86400, which is a motorsport sustainable team kit brand, which I found, which is really cool. And I basically, all the team kits I made out of ocean plastic. So kind of fun stuff like that as well. But long term, I feel like the place we should be heading if we achieve that is that the ACO and FIA are very much making it more difficult for teams to get licenses to race in championships, kind of like in Formula E and Formula One, where you must have a you must achieve a certain level of sustainability for you to be even able to apply for a license in a certain championship. And that's happened in Formula One, but not yet in all the other championships. So kind of there will be an issue then with smaller teams that are not Formula One teams that maybe can't afford, you know, a full-time person to only run sustainability programs for every single team. I mean, if you try to implement that in WEC, a lot of teams would just be like, yeah, we don't have the budget for that. So creating a platform through Green Future Project in which we basically become an advisor to multiple teams where we can simply, at a very, very low price for these teams, give them exactly what they need to do, give them basically like an instruction manual, guide them through the first couple of months of implementation, and then at a low price, be able to give them the opportunity to, you know, get their licenses. So that's, let's say, if that kind of gets implemented, I think that's where we'll go. And yeah, I mean, in the end, I think we've achieved what we wanted to achieve with the project. And if these kind of legislations get pulled in, I think, and teams will be forced to find people to become more sustainable, then we'll really be able to strive.
Sounds great. Sounds like a really decent ambition. And of course, now you're actually turning your focus to how teams are funded with Rebel Team and I saw the revelation, brilliant play on words. It's something completely different, completely innovative in motorsport. So tell us a little bit about the project of the Rebel Team. What is it all about?
So Rebel Team is essentially a way to have, rather than having to go to major companies or team owners or single people that end up kind of controlling the driver market and the sport in itself, to make choices, to do everything around the sport, rather give that kind of power at a low price to basically, my image is basically a grandstand of fans. We're selling the opportunity at a low price and a limited amount to people that really, really are in love with motorsport, that can get frustrated that maybe they can only ever go and watch, and might want to be able to play a role in the future in motorsport and just become more involved in the sport. The experience that we're trying to create is, that we are creating is essentially like in a video game. If you go to Assetto Corsa or iRacing, any of these racing games, what you do is sit down, you take your controller, and then you kind of, you know, pick your car, pick your style, your colors, and your driver and your track, and then off you go and you race. And essentially in that same experience, except for that, instead of then racing on a game, it'll go and race at Le Mans. And it'll kind of be this sort of special thing where people can, you know, go to Le Mans and with their kids or just by themselves and point at the Rebel Team car and be like, I put that driver in that car. I designed that car and be part of that whole, you know, be on the bridge between the paddock and the grandstand. And to me, this concept is not necessarily very new because of how we're doing it. It's existed for a while, not in sports. It's existed in the digital world of blockchain technology. And this is where this is the technology we're using to have the verification processes and make it as seamless as possible. And in blockchain, which is kind of this huge technology coming towards us, and some people might know or might not know, there's this huge movement of, in my eyes, a form of tribalism, where people are putting their money together and up in one pot and then together deciding what they want to do with that. And that's basically called a decentralized autonomous organization, where there's no leader, there's no one person in charge. You might have a founder, But as soon as that founder has put that in place, everybody who is in that decentralized autonomous organization decides what happens with the money that's in that pot, and they vote. And this has been going on for a while now on the internet for lots of different art projects and different kind of sponsorship arrangements for like different kinds of events and in lots of different ways, but it hasn't quite reached the real world for us quite yet. And that's what I'm trying to do. I think that most of those kind of DAOs have been super well-versed in the digital world, which a lot of us are not really a part of yet. And this is going to be one of the, I think, most exciting projects ever to have some sort of digital governance, some sort of decentralized organization, which is happening in the real world. So we'll use the same software, but as soon as the votes have been cast by the people who are inside that organization, Rebel Team, those things will happen in real life. And it's cool because everything is super transparent. All of the funds are completely transparent. So there's no funny business with the money. The fans will see where it's all going, where, you know, which team, which, you know, we have to pay all these different kind of things and do it all in that pot. And they'll be able to decide where to go. If we have excess amounts of money, they'll be able to choose if we want to go to Daytona or maybe do a new car livery or, you know, do any of that kind of business. And it's all decided by these, you know, 10,000 people without a leader, let's say. I mean, I'm the one that started it. I'm the founder. I'm the racing driver. I'm the face of it. And I hope that gives it some sort of authenticity. But essentially, as soon as it's running, I hope to not really have to play a big role in there except for, oh, you want this color, this race? Okay, let's go do that. Kind of gamifying the experience of being a fan in real world motorsport, I think is what we're trying to do. And creating more value. Of course, there's like, it's going to go much more deeper than just the sort of digital governance on Rebel Team. It'll include, you know, virtual events, being able to have people around the world join us virtually at the races. So since the people who are in Rebel Team, in my eyes, are the team owner, they should also receive more information than you normally would on a TV. So if you buy a Rebel Team membership pass, you'll also have access to our Discord, where we'll be giving you exclusive access to our live onboard, to some data, to some strategy information, all that kind of stuff, which you'd never have access to from the grandstand. You'll have access to the radio. You'll be able to listen to our radio communication constantly. So that kind of stuff is really cool. And also before every race, we'll be hosting online racing events on iRacing, where people that have a Rebel Team membership pass can partake. And if you win that race, you'll get an immediate pass to our catering the next weekend and spend the whole weekend with the drivers. So kind of try to add value to a fan base that ends up actually funding financially the racing car, which gives them the opportunity to take all decisions.
That's fantastic. And that security and transparency is so important, especially in the digital world. But then to be able to see it as a product, as the car going around Le Mans, it must be absolutely thrilling. What an opportunity.
Yeah, so obviously we have to wait and we'll start selling these membership passes in September, start of September. That's when we sort of have to try to see what we can do with sales, see how many people are really interested in this, because we do have to reach about a third of our sales by the end of the year to really be able to securely say we can fund the whole project. We have alternative options where we can still give people the experience that they want depending on our success rate. If we sell out fully, which of course I'm hoping and aiming to achieve, we'll be able to do a lot of cool things with launch parties into which every single person will be invited to special locations that you'll only have access to through Rebel Team, and just be able to be closer to the racing drivers themselves, which is kind of what we should be doing anyways. Like the fans, in the end of the day, are funding all racing teams because they're the reasons why sponsors sponsor cars. Sponsor cars because fans see the sponsorship on the car. So the fan then buys the product, that then gives the financial benefit to the sponsor, and they pay the teams to put their branding on the car, amongst other reasons. But in a nutshell, that's kind of one of the big reasons. You know, in Le Mans, 300,000 people are there. it's quite valuable for brand exposure. But instead of going to sponsors to create ad space for fans that they'll end up seeing and anyways end up being the product consumer, I'm just like, avoid that, go straight to the fans and be like, listen, this is the budget for a racing car. This is what it costs. This is what it would cost to do an epic program, to do the whole World Endurance Championships, to do Le Mans. Let's do this together. Let's create a grandstand of Rebel Team fans, of owners that don't have to go and buy anything except for this one membership pass. It's going to be €300 for the season. And you get to experience everything, like choosing drivers, choosing liveries, choosing everything, getting opportunities to win parts of cars and everything. So come to events. I think that's pretty special. So hopefully there we'll get that kind of traction.
Yeah, I really like this concept. I think it's really, you know, the innovation side of it's fantastic. Do you see this as the beginning of the end of traditional sponsorship?
I think sponsors are still necessary. Like, mm-hmm. We'll probably still have sponsors on the car because, but only sponsors that don't impede the governance rights of the owners of the car. So if a sponsor wants to be on the car to help with the funding, without taking anything away from the fans, I'm happy with that. That's awesome. It's more about giving the fans what they deserve, the power that they deserve. And so I still think sponsors are super important. Like the sponsor Skechers, the shoe brand that we've been supported by over the last 2 years at WRC, like without them, nothing would have been possible. And in the end, all they really want is for us to wear Skechers. And I think that's legit, you know? So no, I don't see that as the end. I see it as a very, very hopeful route, especially for young drivers who are now going to be focusing more on social media to gain funding for their careers, because racing is an extremely expensive sport to get into, unreachable for most. And the problem with F4, for example, is that you don't have a viewership. People don't watch F4. You have a very small fan base with, I don't know, 10,000 people or something, but that's not enough to sell, you know, to ask for $400,000 from a sponsor. So creating, you know, giving fans the opportunity to support a young kid, you know, through F4, F3, F2, possibly F1 even, I think that's a kind of a thing that could become the future of, you know, supporting young drivers directly from people that love the sport. And I think that there's enough out there that want to do that. But it was just impossible, because if you're a fan that wants to support a young kid in F4, because you're frustrated about all the drivers in F1, and in the future you want to have one of your drivers in there, maybe from Australia, for example, and there's this Australian F4 kid, you're not going to give him $400,000. You don't have that. Mm. But maybe €100, you know, a bunch of people give €100, can cover maybe half the cost, and you have enough people, like a fan base on your social medias to do that. I think that's, this is what for me is Rebel Team is the start of that, I hope. I think we want to, for example, one of my ideas that I'd like to propose to the fans, if, for example, we have a great success and we actually have excess amount of funds, I'd love to propose to them, let's give $50,000 to some kid in F4. Who do you want, you know? If that can happen next year already, that would be like a dream come true for me. And then creating that idea of like supporting drivers that fans want to support for a small amount of money, but a huge amount of impact. So just kind of creating communities to support drivers, that would be really cool. But in big time motorsport, like if Rebel Team ends up having a driver in F1 in 5-6 years time, which is another one of my long-term dreams, to have enough of a community to do that, like that'd be just incredible. Like a group of fans influencing actual driver lineups in F1 would be mind blowing. So do I think it's the end of something? No. Do I think it's a new opportunity? Yes. And I hope that this will become a more powerful factor than sponsors. And I think in the end, actually, you'll attract more new sponsors by being this kind of community driven company where we're about people, we're about giving power to people. This is something that's coming up more and more and is more and more required, I think, in the world that we live in today. And this kind of tribalism feeling of like grouping together everything, I think that's quite attractive to sponsors. So maybe that will increase possible sponsorship. And okay. In the end, also Rebel Team, we're looking for partners to host events. For example, like we want to have 4 real live events with, you know, couple thousand people, we're going to need a sponsor for that. But that's pretty cool. Like, you can sponsor an event with a couple thousand motorsport fans. You'll find sponsors for that kind of thing. So new sponsorship directions are what will be required. And I think this is what should be happening.
Yeah. And I think also what you say there around the engagement with fans, we're always looking to get closer to the action when and bringing people in. You know, we've seen things like Drive to Survive in Formula One that has engaged fans, given them that sort of behind the curtain look. And I think actually the next stage of that is actually taking that on track, because as you say, yes, what, you know, with Ignition, we've worked with young drivers in Formula 4, Formula 3, DTM. And it is very difficult to get on track if you've got a bit of talent, but not a lot of money. So yes, I think that, you know, anything you do towards the model there is needed, quite frankly. Yeah. And I think a hybrid model between, as you say, the traditional sponsorship and what you're doing with Rebel Team is probably the perfect blend.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're trying to do here. We're trying to, you know, test the waters, see what it's like, what's the market like. Currently, with the financial, you know, situation of the world, it's I think, a really bad, difficult time to enter this kind of thing. But you've got to try. You've got to see what it's up. You've got to test the waters out. And hopefully people are interested enough to, you know, partake in this experience. And if it doesn't necessarily fully work program in year one, year two is going to be just as hopefully as exciting and blinding when we have our community growing. So this is more of a long-term concept, just a one-year thing.
And where can people find more about it? Ultimately, people listening, where can they log on and find more about it?
Rebelteam.com will have all the information. Our socials are up and running. Rebelteam.com is on Instagram and Twitter. And on first week of August, we'll be launching our Discord, which will have, I think, most of the discussions and information that you'll need to partake. And so I'm on Instagram, fhabslog62. I'm getting a lot of people messaging me about it, asking how they can partake in it and being on a whitelist. So the first people that can be part of the first people to buy. So all that kind of stuff is already available. But yeah, we're just trying to create some traction now, see what we're looking at, and give it a crack.
Fantastic.
Such a phenomenal idea. I know it's gonna absolutely fly. I've just got that feeling this is gonna be something formative. So all power to you for doing it. We will put those links in the show notes to make it easy for people to get in touch. Renew Podcast, this is all about tomorrow's motorsport. So we have a signature question that we will be asking everybody on the podcast. So Ferdinand, in very general terms, where is motorsport right now, in your opinion, in terms of its relevance and its health? And where do you see tomorrow's motorsport heading?
It's at a tipping point in multiple reasons, or not necessarily a huge tipping point, but an important moment for a couple of reasons. One, Formula One's budget caps has, I think, made a huge impact on having a more healthy driver market. Having a more natural, making it a bit fairer for smaller teams to partake. I think that creates more excitement, and that's great. I think that's one reason. I think that's one step that had to be taken ages ago, but finally happened. The World Endurance Championship finally getting traction with its hypercar in 2024 at Le Mans, with I think it's like 8 or 9 different manufacturers now. That is huge. Just seeing what they're getting onto when it comes to innovation, for example, using fuels made out of rubbish or synthetic fuels in general, coming in more and more into our racing, and LMP2 us using synthetic fuels already is fascinating, and I hope to see that keep on develop. Formula E obviously is at an interesting point where it's having its initial manufacturers leave, but new manufacturers coming in with, for example, Maserati, amongst others, and McLaren and stuff like that. So I'd say had such strength by having the huge manufacturers like BMW, Mercedes, Audi. They've gone now, and it's now been taken over by smaller manufacturers, which I think is a really interesting thing that happened, which I can't quite understand why yet. But I think next year's Formula E season is going to be absolutely interesting with the next generation Formula E cars. These championships, the big ones, have all been changing in a really positive way. The ones that haven't changed at all, which I find really depressing, is Formula 2 and Formula 3. You know, it's really sad because they are the birth ground for our future racing drivers. And it's just a catastrophe how they've been run, how their financial systems work. It's just, that's the one that's been staying the same people in charge, no differences in cars, just getting heavier and useless and difficult and no testing and expensive like crazy. So I really, really, really hope to be seeing some changes in that area. Also, even trickling down to F4, it's just getting ridiculous, and go-karting even. I think that, you know, Le Mans is coming back to its strengths. It's finally moving away from just having one manufacturer, Toyota, winning it, and that just becoming boring. But really having a huge amount of competition from here and overseas. That's really exciting. Seeing the, unfortunately leaving, seeing GTE leave, which is really sad, and GT3 is taking over the world. And LMP2 kind of leaving as well. Let me think a little bit deeper, maybe. Virtually, we need to up our game a little bit more. I think that these kind of concepts of fan-based financial systems in 4 to 5 years will become more common. I think Rebel Team hopefully is just setting a precedence and showing people what can be done, and hope that we'll have a lot of competition in 5 years, because it means we've done the right thing. I think that fan engagement will be key. I think that that will become more natural. I think we'll probably have people plastering their own faces on the cars or their own NFTs or their own kind of blockchain-y style things. You can already see it happening with all of these huge crypto sponsors in F1, you know, just swarming the market with the biggest sponsorship deals you've ever seen in motorsport history. So you can see it, the tsunami is coming in a good way. The future, man, what's the future? Yeah, I hope we get, you know, more opportunities for young kids to get into Formula One, and that includes boys and girls. I don't see W Series being a huge success, unfortunately. I hope that that can be improved, maybe to truly give you know, at least a woman the opportunity to get there.
W Series is an interesting one, isn't it? Where do you think that blockage is? Is it similar to kind of the other feeder series in terms of where the obstacles end up for W Series? If you see what I mean, of someone like Jamie actually then making that proper step forward into a seat, or is it something different that what W Series has to contend with?
I think it was a great idea, but unfortunately, in my personal opinion, it was extremely well marketed but poorly executed, in the way that you really ended up hurting all these girls by not having them race against boys. You need the toughest competition in the world to even remotely get good. Like, I needed Lando Norris as my teammate for 2 years to actually become a racing driver. I without Lando, I don't think I would be a Le Mans winner or a WEC champion or you know, I wouldn't be a professional racing driver. That wouldn't be the case. I needed Lando to destroy me, to make me question my own physical abilities and really dig deep and go testing. Like when I was testing, getting out of the car, scratching my head because I got beaten by 2 seconds in the wet, you know? And you're like, this is just painful. Like, it was painful and I needed it. And you can't take away this kind of competition by keeping them separate, because as soon as they come back in, they're going to be destroyed. But that would happen with anybody, you know. If I didn't have competition like Lando or Leclerc or these kind of guys to race against, or then in DTM, Paul Di Resta and Gianni Giancadea, these guys, I'd just be shit. I'd just be a shit driver. So I feel like what they should have done is taken all of that beautiful marketing and money that they ended up spending on these 20 girls and creating a W Series junior program in which you fully funded two or three girls in a feeder series like Formula Renault or F4 or F3, where they were racing against the boys with the same amount of testing, the same amount of practice, absolutely full ham on these two or three girls that won the competition of W Series, and give them the best opportunity they have. You're just not going to get you're not going to get a James LeBron if you didn't have his teammates to push him, you know, like to this extreme heights. And it's just, that's how sport runs. And anybody that's been an athlete knows what I mean. It's just the way it is. And keeping them in a bubble was not the right answer.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think competition is key. I think exactly the same in business. If you haven't got your competitors, well, you just sit there and go, well, this is nice. You need people exactly. out there to either aspire to or fight against. And you see it. It'll be very interesting to see how Rebel Team develops when you start seeing people coming up with a similar concept. You mentioned that earlier in terms of, well, what's, and suddenly you've created something. You'll have a lot of people also that are very much on the traditional sponsorship route who go, who are these guys coming along? And gradually over time, they might start realizing that they shouldn't have sneered or thought, oh, well, they'll be gone soon, because the world keeps on changing, people moving forward. And quite frankly, if you can't move forward, then if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. It's as simple as that. So no, I think you raised some good points there. And I think that particularly around your own, you know, fights with Lando Norris, and, you know, you have to dig deeper and fight harder.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that those are my roundabout positives and negatives of motorsport world. I personally, if I can go back to your initial question, for me, I always say this, I am an obsessive racing driver, but I'm not a huge motorsport fan. Like, I literally can't think of anything better than racing cars. It's like the coolest thing in the world. But like I like following Formula One, Formula E, and I obviously race in WEC. But in general, I love what I'm doing, and I feel responsible towards the fans. That's Rebel Team, essentially. Those are my roundabout my current thoughts on racing and where we're at the moment.
Ferdinand, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing those thoughts and speaking to you today, and for you to take some time out of your vacation to do so. I look so much forward to these projects that you're embarking on. So we'll close there. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks. Cheers.
This is Tomorrow's Motorsport.